Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
We're talking about these transcendent, eternal truths that are very subtle, very difficult to pin down, and often multiple perspectives are the closest approach that we can make to them. But that often appears paradoxical.
Jason Brett Searle. I'm going to spell the name in case you're doing a Google search. It's Jason Brett. You know how that goes. And S-E-R-L-E, Searle. All right. So now you have to Google it. The book, The Monkey and the Bodhi Tree, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Everybody, language is different. Crazy Wisdom and the Way of the Wise Fool. How'd I do, Jason?
Excellent. Exactly how it is, yeah.
Okay, see, I'm already asking. Please, can you help me? And that, basically, the book is about wisdom, and it doesn't have to be all of that, you know, go to a book and everything, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. It has to be sometimes the way of the clown. When doing something backwards is actually wise because it gets you to think. You have a wonderful background. Can you give us an idea of a little bit about you just to hear this before we get started?
Okay, so I'm originally from the UK, born in England, raised till my early teens in the UK, and then my family moved to Spain. I've always been interested in writing and communication, and so I've published over the years several books. And that's led me into the world of filmmaking, documentary filmmaking. So I've made a couple of full-length documentary films. I was also a musician some years ago, not doing so much of that now, but all threaded together with this common theme of lyrics, communication, words. That also took me into the world of neuro-linguistic programming, and I became a master NLP practitioner as well as a certified hypnotist. Hypnotherapist. So yeah, I've always had an interest in language, in particular the English language, and I've always had an interest in the big questions of life, of, you know, the existential questions, spirituality. So I've, from my late teens, I've investigated most spiritual paths. I think they all lead to the same ultimate goal. That's what they're trying to achieve. And yeah, The Monkey and the Bodhi Tree is my last writing and offering to the world.
And reading the background, the bio, it's like you've done a little bit of everything. And I think communication is the core. So when you're putting this book together, you're trying to get information from all different esoteric beliefs and put it together in a way that Western minds might be used to accessing it. In other words, language can be confusing sometimes because some places there are multiple words for one thing. And I think you tried to address that in the book and then put everything together so that we could, I think, appreciate the wisdom.
Yes. Well, I mean, language is one of these tricky things, that it can be a trap or it can be the means of escape. So it's the finger pointing to the moon, isn't it? If you have to turn away from the person pointing to actually see the moon. So it's once again that sort of strange, paradoxical nature of language, that if we stay looking at the pointer or obsessed with the words and the language, we must actually transcend the language in essence, turn our heads, make a 180-degree turn away from the communicator or the pointer to see what they're attempting to point at. And so that's one of the points of the book and one of the things that creates the paradoxical crazy wisdom is the limited nature of language, in that all the great sages have been sort of emphatic that language cannot reach ultimate truth, and yet they don't stop talking about it. So you need the right listener as well as the right talker. When you have the right communicator and the right person listening in the right way, then they can turn around and see the moon for themselves. And language has the ability to do that. And it also has the ability to keep people very trapped if they don't turn around and look away from it and look beyond the words, you know?
We have the book in two parts. The original, or the beginning, is basically an instruction of this is how I compiled this and this is why it's important. And these are the ways that we are working together to figure out wisdom. I'll just condense it that way. And then the second part of the book, 151 Teaching Tales from Around the World, and chosen to illustrate this kind of crazy wisdom. So do you have a favorite example?
One of the stories. Okay.
Yeah.
So many. And that was, funnily enough, the book actually began as a book about Mullah Nasruddin. Now, Mullah Nasruddin is the archetypal wise fool for the Arab world, basically. So all of their stories of this nature, Sufi teaching tales, to sometimes just bawdy jokes, often have the character of Mullah Nasruddin as the protagonist. The typical character, is he really stupid or is he really clever or is, you know what I mean? Or where is he on this spectrum? Mm-hmm. And he's that archetypal trickster, wise fool type character. And I've always loved his stories. There was a series of books that came out in the 60s by Idris Shah. And this was really the first time that Mullah Nasruddin had been introduced to the West in the English language. And they're beautiful books. And from there, I sort of, anything I could get my hands on, Mullah Nasruddin stories, you know, I would gobble up. But it occurred to me that I was very interested in the Sufi-type teaching tales that feature Mullah Nasruddin. And I didn't really have much time for some of the jokey-type stories that were a bit bawdy and a bit sort of, you know, crass at times. So I thought my initial intention was, hey, why don't I write a book and I'll select all the good Sufi type crazy wisdom teaching tales of Mullah Nasruddin and make an anthology of those and introduce him and sort of that was the slant. And as I was writing in the writing of this, I found that there were these stories that featured Mullah Nasruddin that when I actually looked deeper into it, Mullah Nasruddin wasn't the protagonist. It was Zen Master Ikkyu or something. You know, it was a story that had come from the East, and in moving into the Arab world, they changed the name with their favorite wise fool character, and it becomes a Mullah Nasruddin story, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I found that I'd got all these stories, and there were a bunch of them that I was in a dilemma. Do I just put Mullah Nasruddin, even though, you know, you can actually historically find that this is a Buddhist story or this is from the holy fools of Christianity or the Desert Fathers or this sort of thing. And then it sort of, I had a light bulb moment where it was like, well, of course, I've always been very eclectic in my tastes in most things, and especially spirituality. I love the Jains of India. I love the Buddhist tradition. I love the mystical Christian tradition. I think they're all beautiful, to be honest, you know, as I've delved into them deeper and deeper, they've all provided grist for my spiritual mill, so to speak, you know. And so it was a moment that I realized, why didn't I think of this sooner? You know, this isn't a book about Mullah Nasruddin. This is a book about crazy wisdom in its universal aspect. This is wherever it raises its crazy head throughout all the wisdom traditions on the planet. This is what it should be about, which, you know, allowed me to keep those stories and be a bit more true to their original protagonist. So, you know, the Ikkyu stories or the Zen master stories took back their original protagonist names. And it just sort of blossomed from there. And as I started getting further into the different crazy wisdom aspects of the wisdom traditions, then I started sort of expanding on the whole theme, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we end up with a book in two parts where it's sort of loosely separated into theory and practice. So part one is a kind of explanation of what is crazy wisdom and how is it defined and how does it differ from divine madness or other terms that are sometimes taken as synonyms, but they're perhaps not quite. And so I wanted to kind of lay out the theoretical landscape of what is crazy wisdom. I wanted to illustrate some of its great luminaries, its sages and mad saints. And then, of course, the part two is the kind of practical aspect, so to speak, which is 151 of these short stories. Some of them are based on real life happenings, and others are sort of for illustrative purposes. They're sort of teaching tales, and they cover the whole gamut of crazy wisdom, you know, from the Mullah Nasruddin to the Zen masters and the holy fools of Christianity and everything in between. So this one's called The Cost of the Slap. Nasruddin was having a heated debate with another man about nonviolence when suddenly, in anger, the man slapped Nasruddin across the face. The mullah took the man to court, but when they arrived there, the judge greeted the man warmly, and it was clear that they knew each other well. After an overly brief trial, the judge handed down an extremely lenient sentence. "I deem the fine for a slap to be one silver coin," the judge proclaimed. "If you don't have it, then go home and get one and bring it here." The man left the courthouse, and the mullah sat down to wait for his return. After several hours of waiting, and with no sign of the man, Nasruddin jumped to his feet, approached the judge, and slapped him across the face. "When he finally gets back," the mullah said to him as he turned to leave, "you have the coin."
There's some humor and joy and irreverence in all of these. Okay, and
yeah,
just
absolutely.
What I tried to do, since we have a short time, was to pick these short examples. And I had a couple of favorites. One was The Weight of the World, and the other one is To the Point. And do you offhand know that, or I could share? I can do one while you look up the other one. How's that?
Give me the page for the other one.
The first one is The Weight of the World, and the monk who's weeding. And I don't have the page. I don't have the page number.
Okay.
And the other one is To the Point. I'll do that one because it's also short. And To the Point.
Okay.
A cousin of Nasruddin had moved to a distant village. He left some of his possessions, as well as his cat, with the mullah for safekeeping. One day the cat died, and Nasruddin sent his cousin a simple message, "Your cat is dead." His cousin responded, "Do you not understand tact? Where I'm from, you'd perhaps first say, 'I think your cat has a furball. He seemed to be coughing a lot.' Then perhaps later, 'He seems quite ill.' Before finally saying, 'I'm sorry to say he's passed away.'" Several months later, his cousin received a letter from Nasruddin saying, "I think your mother has a furball." Look, that was my favorite.
He's lovely, I know. That's a great one.
I'm like, oh my, I think your mother has a furball. Okay, well, that's to the point, but not quite the whole point.
Yeah.
So these are the wonderful examples. Okay, and did you find The Weight of the World?
The Weight of the World, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so a monk was doing some weeding in the monastery's vegetable garden when he came to a particularly large and resistant weed. After a short struggle, he managed to pull it up. A fellow brother, who had been watching him from over the wall, remarked, "Well done, you must be very strong to pull up such a big weed." "Not really," the monk replied. "I had the whole world pulling from the other side."
Yeah.
And once again, these are all designed to throw us like jokes. Like you did allude to them having an element of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And often good humor, there's a lead up. It takes you down a certain path. And then the punchline serves to completely derail where you were headed with your thinking as to what was coming and what was the situation, you know?
I love it.
So a lot of these crazy wisdom tales are designed to do that, to sort of upend our rational faculties, to allow other aspects of reality or other perspectives, other ways of seeing the world, even though they might be sort of irreverent and strange and paradoxical, to briefly kind of illuminate our mind, so to speak, you know?
You get out of that logical mind where everything follows a certain path or a certain trajectory, a certain pattern. And this is where the anomaly comes into play, where you're like, oh, I didn't even think of that. Why didn't I think of that? Wow, that's brilliant. And then, you know, it's like, it was so irreverent. So reading these, it's just a joy. And so, you know, that thing is the crazy wisdom. I wasn't sure what you were going to address and how you were going to bring it in. But the ones you've chosen are just, they make you feel good, okay?
Indeed, these are a lot of the tales of Mullah Nasruddin. If you look into the sort of tradition of Sufism, you find that they're actually used as almost like a Zen koan would be used. So the Zen koan would be something that a monk would mull over and think about for often weeks or months or sometimes even years at a time. And in a similar way, the Sufis would use some of these more elevated teaching tales as a kind of means of meditation and a means to sort of transcend their reasoning minds and reach these sort of moments of epiphany and realization. So I think they're, you know, they can be read on several different levels as well, often like scripture and like any sort of deep, meaningful writing. There's often several levels of interpretation to them.
I like it because even if you know, set aside one a week or one a day or one, you know, to give your time up to thinking about it and thinking about how it changed you by hearing it, your thinking and your perception, it's a way to learn and expand your own awareness of, wow, my mind was going this direction and how did that shift me? And now I have a new awareness or an epiphany of how it worked. There's another one in here, two wrongs don't make a right. Or I'm sorry, two rights. You have to say it right first, not wrong. So two rights don't make a wrong. And it's page 343. You want to share that one?
Yeah. Two rights don't make a wrong. Once again, these are good old Nasruddin. So Judge Nasruddin was presiding over a case. After hearing the declaration of the plaintiff and being impressed by his eloquence and argument, Nasruddin somewhat prematurely declared to him, "I believe you are right." "Objection, Your Honor," came a voice from the defense. "You have yet to even hear the other side of the story." "Of course," said Nasruddin, composing himself. "Sorry, please go ahead." After hearing another compelling speech from the defense, the mullah said to him, "I believe you are right." At this point, the clerk of the court interjected and said to Nasruddin, "Your Honor, they cannot both be right." At which point Nasruddin responded once again, "I believe you are right." Case dismissed.
They're so simple, so easy, if life were just that easy.
Well, this is another sort of aspect of crazy wisdom. At the higher levels of understanding things, it's not about, the truth isn't captured by one perspective. The truth is captured more accurately by multiple perspectives on the same thing. So this is part of what often creates the paradoxical declarations of these saints and sages. And a lot of people might accuse them of being charlatans because they don't appear to be consistent in what they say. And they're dealing on levels of understanding that it's not about consistency. It's about context. You get into nuances and subtler levels of understanding, whereas, you know, it's not always X or it's not always Y. It depends, you know, reality is a sort of shifting phenomena depending on who's perceiving it and in what light and in what context. And so a lot of these crazy wisdom teachers and masters are only too well aware of this aspect of reality and this aspect of truth with a capital T. You know, we're not talking about lower material truths that we can objectively all look at and agree upon. We're talking about these transcendent, eternal truths that are very subtle, very difficult to pin down, and often multiple perspectives are the closest approach that we can make to them. But that often appears paradoxical.
And I don't want you to read every single one, But the fact that these are so illuminating and they illustrate the kind of wisdom that you are pointing out. There's a one called Arresting the Stone Buddha, and it's right there in the same area, 342. This is another perspective and a little bit longer story, but it also makes a beautiful point.
Shall I read this one?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. A merchant who had been carrying 50 rolls of cotton on his shoulders stopped beneath a shelter where a large statue of the Buddha stood to rest from the heat of the day. As he lay in the shade, he dozed off, and when he finally awoke, he found that all his goods had been stolen. Immediately, he went to the authorities to report the matter. A judge named Ouka was called to investigate. That stone Buddha must have stolen the goods, he concluded, and in any case, his duty is to protect the welfare of the people, and in this case, he has failed. Arrest him. Police were sent, and the stone Buddha was carried to the courthouse, followed by a large, noisy crowd of curious onlookers. When Ouka appeared on the bench, he scolded the boisterous crowd. What sort of behavior is this for a courthouse, laughing and joking and causing all manner of mayhem? He said to them. I find you all in contempt of court and subject to a fine and possibly imprisonment, he continued. Those assembled quickly began to quiet down and apologize. I shall impose a fine, continued the judge, that will be pardoned, provided that each and every one of you bring a roll of cotton to this courthouse within 3 days. Anyone failing to do this will be arrested. The people hurried away and began bringing their cotton goods to the courthouse. One of them was recognized by the merchant as his own, and the thief was discovered. His goods were recovered, the other rolls were returned to their rightful owners, and the stone Buddha returned to his place. Although it had not stopped the theft, it had instead found the thief.
A completely now, different direction.
Yes, and this is apparently from a true tale. This is apparently based upon something that did actually happen. Some of the stories are crazy wisdom in the sense of people acting in ways that initially make no sense until, of course, you see the outcome of those actions. And as you see in this case, the judge discovered the thief by his strange contrived action of bringing a stone Buddha in, and obviously that was all sort of contrived for this purpose.
Yep.
So it's the employment of unconventional means in order to resolve issues, no? To resolve problems, and that would be very wise to do, no? A judge discovering who the thief is in the easiest manner, where basically they're turning themselves in, is very clever.
Yeah.
And done in a very unconventional and sort of crazy manner, you know?
Well, that's what I like about these. There's wisdom in it and the ways that people have figured out how to get us to expose ourselves in a way that, you know, we're not anticipating and trying to get away from it, because at the beginning, they're all on the same page. They're all in a group together, and who would expect that the thief was also there and curious about what was happening? And and as it turns out, turns themselves in. What got you interested in these kinds of topics? Because it seems that there is a theme in the things that you are searching out, seeking out. It has to do with wisdom. It has to do with basically self-improvement and learning, personal growth, all of that. It's but doing it in a way that takes you over the globe in different cultures. Each has something to offer.
Absolutely. I can remember sort of even quite as a boy being puzzled by the sort of the issues between religions. You know, it seemed quite clear to me from a very early age that when Muslims talk about Allah and Christians talk about God, they obviously, well, just listen to the description, they're talking about the same thing. We wouldn't get confused you know, by a Spaniard saying agua and an English person saying water. We're quite clear that they're talking about the same thing. But somehow in sort of orthodox or conventional exoteric religion, there's always been this sort of inability to recognize that we're all dealing with the same thing. We're all approaching this same thing. And from an early age, it was just, I was fascinated by spirituality, by the potential of the human being, the undiscovered or unfulfilled potential that people have. And I think, to be honest, my early days in making music had a lot to do with it, because I found myself in a position of having to write lyrics. And so it struck me from quite early on, like, you know, I've got to say something worthwhile saying. And then you sort of, if you go down that rabbit hole, it can be quite deep. Well, what's worth saying? You know? So I think there are several threads. As with most people's lives, there are many threads that all pull together in certain directions, and propensities of, you know, a intellectual person who does a lot of thinking and pondering stuff. And so I was just naturally drawn to these things, and other aspects of my personality. You know, I've had a fairly marked rebellious streak. And so obviously in the world of spirituality, you feel you feel that you're in tune with certain characters that share some of how you feel. And so a lot of these people are unconventional and idiosyncratic and peculiar and eccentric. And these are all aspects of that I kind of recognize in my own personality. And so it's not a great leap for me to be fascinated in particular in my studies of the different religions and wisdom traditions, to be fascinated in particular with people like Mulla Nasruddin and Drukpa Kunli, who is one of the Tibetan wise fools, and all of these type of saints who do have a very solid, principled, moral aspect to them, and yet this sort of vein of eccentricity and doing things their own way and not following the crowd and often going in, you know, complete opposition to the crowd if needs be.
The other books you have, A Kissing Achilles' Heel, The Joyful Unmasking of Delusion is one, and that's another one that has tales that are, it's 63 short pieces, parables, fables, stories, commentaries, poems. And it's the same, it's along the same line. There's another one, Sacred Mushroom of Visions, a source book on the psilocybin mushroom. And this gets into another aspect, basically, I think, of consciousness and how you expand your view, your in so many ways, your entire personhood when you either ingest or are participating in some way without ingesting in these kinds of practices, spiritual practices. And this is another adventure and something that you have obviously taken time to do some research on. So were you participating or just researching? How did that come about?
Well, this was, in my studying of the wisdom traditions, you can't avoid coming across shamanism and the use of plant teachers and these sort of substances throughout every culture, really, that they've used them. And so this, in my sort of early mid-20s, I went down this sort of road, and I came across Terence McKenna, who was talking a lot about the shamanic tradition, and he introduced me to what he called the heroic dose and a particular way of taking psychedelics. See, the shamans, there were generally two different ways that they'd be taken. And one would be in a social setting with music and drumming and chanting. And often it was for, you know, reasons of social cohesion or discovering lost objects or these sort of things. And there was this other context, which was the vision quest, which was the shaman deepening his knowledge. And he would do this by taking a heroic dose, high dose, in absolute silence and absolute darkness and absolute solitude. And this was a sort of thorn in my mind that wouldn't go away until I sort of had done it. So I took it very seriously, and I grew the mushrooms myself and sort of developed that respect for them and that relationship with them. And I fasted the whole day and prepared a sort of ritual for taking them. And I was seeking what people have sought for thousands of years, which is, you know, the beatific vision, the mystical experience, cosmic consciousness. And, you know, I'd had fleeting glimpses through meditation practice and this sort of thing. But there was nothing like what was revealed to me that night as I sort of lay in this dark room, dribbling on my pillow and blending into the cosmos. So yes, I've experimented later on with DMT, the most powerful hallucinogen known to man, and this was with a Mexican shaman. And I recognize that they're very powerful tools for, you know, microscopes into consciousness. And for me, it gave me the taste of the mystical experience that I've been searching for, that allowed me to sort of consolidate my interests in pursuing spirituality as a way of life rather than as a sort of side interest or hobby, or sort of got that out of the way, so to speak, as well, you know, because a lot of seekers can be yearning after that experience for years and hold it out in front of them like the carrot. Ultimately, what we're seeking is not that.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at freestylelibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
It's not practical to be in that sort of state 24 hours a day anyway, you know. It's the typical sort of Zen phrase of carry water, chop wood, you know. Ultimately, we're here, we have our day-to-day, we have families, we have relationships, we have work, you know. Unless you're going the route of the monk and you're absolutely checking out, then life has to be dealt with. And so the mushroom in particular was a very powerful teacher for me that allowed me to have that taste of divine consciousness and gave me that sort of deep faith in the spiritual path and what the sages have been telling us for millennia.
I had an experience like that. It didn't involve any kind of a drug enhancement, nothing. It was, I'm fully conscious, fully sober, but I also am working with spirit guides. And what they told me was that they would count to two. And at this point I was channeling, and my aunt who was working with me, and she was the hypnotherapist also, basically making sure that for me that I stayed grounded. And the thing is, as I am channeling, I'm telling her that we're going to count to two. And that's not coming from me. That's coming from the guides. And I'm thinking, me, the part of me that's still part of this experiment, is thinking, oh yeah, right, count to two. What can you show me in a two count? And so I'm like that, being the little kid. And so then she counts one. And the minute she says one, I'm gone. I am, at that point, like butter. And the whole, it's just, you know, that brilliant, brilliant, and it's like a yellow gold light, and I'm just one with everything that is, has been, and will be, and I'm like, wow, there's no language that can describe it. I can't describe it. I wanted to stay there, okay, because this is nothing anywhere, anytime can replace what I felt in that moment. And then she counts to two, and I'm like, uh-oh. I have to come back. I can't stay where I wanted to stay. Because in my own awareness, I knew it would be like a psychotic break. Only half of me would be here, because the real part of me had just checked out. And with that awareness, I like, okay, I got to come back. Oh, it was like, no. And then I come back, and it was a two count, and it, a whole lot can happen in a two count, just so you know. But no drugs.
Yeah, psychedelic space is exactly that. I mean, the night of my mushrooms was 1,000 years. You know, it was centuries. I was, you know, living lives. And so, yeah, our concept of time is obviously relative. And, but like you saw, there's a chapter in the book about the musts. Now, the must is written M-A-S-T, but it's pronounced like must. Mm-hmm. These are sort of often referred to as casualties on the spiritual path. And they're particularly found in India and Pakistan and these areas of the world. These are sort of people who have such profound transpersonal experiences, utterly beyond their control, that they're, and so frequently that they can no longer hold it together and live the day-to-day life.
Yeah.
And in a place like India, it's actually recognized, and they're not sort of, they don't end up, for the most part, in madhouses, and they're looked after in ashrams, and they're recognized as, you know, being different from a conventional mad person, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But it's really that. It's the inability to, what was the Joseph Campbell, he had a great quote. He said, the psychotic drowns in the same waters that the mystic swims in delight.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And that's exactly it. It's this sort of, it's the same thing. You can be overwhelmed by the mystical experience. And if it's completely beyond your control and you're flipping in and out of these transpersonal states, then it can be a problem, as the must, you know, of India is quite clear. They can't, you know, hold down jobs and live normal lives by any means of the word. But the job of the mystic then is to learn to swim in these same waters, mm-hmm. and be able to dip your head under or tread water, or
you have to come back. And basically the mystic is there to say it can be done and to say that this exists and it is real. It's like, you know, when I hear you talking about the psychedelic experience on whatever level you enter into it, then I'm here to say that you can do it another way. And it's just as effective and just as phantasmagorical, whatever word you want to put on it, that it changes you. It becomes something that you are able to say, oh my gosh, there's something more. It's beyond us and it's here and we can access it. But yeah, if you access it 24/7, you're not going to be here.
Yes, and once again, these are passing moments as well. There, mm-hmm. It's not enlightenment. Ultimately, for me, is something else. Enlightenment is not where you're blissed out 24/7.
No,
it's the ability to infuse the mundane with that same divine import. You know, the day to day, the washing the dishes becomes, you know, not a chore and a hassle that you're looking to escape from and get done as quickly as possible. You can be there doing the dishes and it's enough, you know. I think ultimately the human dilemma is a wish to escape, mm-hmm. in some means what is, right? Whether that is, you know, I need a bigger house or a better car or a better job or a, you know, a more beautiful wife or all, whatever you may crave, it's all the same motivation. It's like what is not satisfactory. Right. And we therefore strive for something else to fill that void. And I think ultimately the enlightened state is the end of that. It's where what is becomes absolutely fulfilling and satisfactory.
Well, you can feel
this. Nothing else is needed.
Yeah, it's a way of connecting with the sublime in the present and seeing that you can go deep into the present when you allow yourself to stay put, when you allow yourself to claim your space and go, oh, this is really cool too. Wow, I didn't see it before because I was always looking somewhere else to get or to be or to have. Instead, I'm going, this is here and this is it's extraordinary. But only if we're willing to stay here and allow it to be. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
The other thing I connected with was the film. You have a film called Mind Your Mind. And this talks about subliminal programming. And I thought, perfect timing, because when I saw this and saw your book, I had just seen in the previous months a show on Netflix, a streaming program, that a series I had been watching and multiple times. So I was very familiar with this show. I could participate without participating. Okay, so there's the mind. It's halfway there. But that's what happens. And I learned, you know, within 30 minutes, if we're watching television or something, that's what our mind does. It kind of goes into la la da 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 da. So there I am in that state. I look up at the screen. I think I'm playing solitaire on my computer, and I'm looking at the. It's very comforting watching this show. So I'm looking, and I love, so I'm there, and I'm in that feel good space, playing solitaire, half in, half out. Look up at the screen, and I see, in this image that's on the screen, which is kind of it's a specific design of geometric shapes. And then there is a word, a white word printed block letters. And I'm thinking, oh, this is subliminal programming. They stuck this in my program. What have I been experiencing and exposed to when I'm in this state? And that was quite the awakening, because I realized here it is and we're experiencing it and nobody knows. You know, it's timely to go back and revisit that, because this is happening under our noses or under our, in our faces, in our spaces, and we're completely, totally unaware and in many ways unprepared. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, the whole idea of the film really was, the more you make people aware of the techniques that are being used against them, the less effective those techniques become, because you start to see them for what they are, you know, just like in your case. When you see consciously subliminal advertising, then that sort of negates the effect it has. The whole, you know, efficiency of it is that it's subliminal. It must be subliminal for it to work. And it works. I mean, they've done experiments in cinemas where they've used subliminal flashes on the screen of popcorn and Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. And the sales have gone up sort of exponentially, sort of 40% increase of sales when they do this. And so these things, although they're illegal in most places, finding people out when you're slipping a frame in, you know, 1/24th of a second frame, it's very hard to catch people out on it. But it does work. And Mind Your Mind, which is called A Primer for Psychological Independence, this was on the back of me studying NLP. I went to London and did these intensive courses studying neuro-linguistic programming. And it was another world opened before me. And I found myself standing in the line in the bank, looking at the posters and going, okay, so they're using nominalizations. And, you know, I had the names for the techniques that they were using in their posters and on the TV commercials, and I could pick things apart and go, oh, now I see how they're doing this. And so it was the desire to share that with a broader audience and make it sort of entertaining and let them know how they're being, how their ideas and their likes and preferences and opinions are being modified by people who are doing it for their own ends, really. Yeah. And like I say, the more that we become aware of them, the less impact they have on us, the more we sort of escape the programming.
Yes. Yeah. Basically, we're being programmed by the programs, which is brilliant.
That's why are they called programs? Yeah. Why are they called programs?
Well, and see, in broadcasting, I remember somebody else, there was, I don't know who told me, but I will never forget it because it makes sense. Every thought before you open your microphone is a programming decision. And because you are determining how you're going to deliver the message and maybe what the purpose, the intent of the message is. And if you waste that moment and not planning and the awareness, you waste the opportunity to make an impact and leave someone with some kind of a message, some kind of information that they can use. You're just kind of babbling. And sometimes that's helpful. When you are being paid to do something, they would appreciate that you actually put some effort into it and have an idea, the purpose, the intent, and the result. So, but that the programming. So I was always aware of that and knowing how important it was. And then when I'm having done this, you know, industry for decades and realizing and knowing that it is not illegal in most places. They, at one point, there was a challenge and they were thinking, no, 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 they decided not to do that. Well, that opened the, that basically opened the door, because it doesn't matter if it isn't happening in your country. It can be done somewhere where it, there's no problem, because the country that it is illegal in, it doesn't have to happen there. You can still be exposed. That's the whole problem with it. I think it's pervasive. I think we are completely lulled into thinking that everything we're exposed to is completely innocent and does not have this kind of influence. And that's where I think your film brings it back to the surface of, hey guys, take a look. What might be happening? And that's what I thought when I saw it. I thought, wow, yay.
The techniques for manipulation have become very sophisticated. And I think that's what most people aren't aware of. That we are, if you understand certain aspects of human psychology, you can get people to do things without their knowledge. Mm. You know, people are very malleable. And words are very powerful things. We, you know, in a one-to-one conversation, we know we can make people smile, we can make people cry, depending on the words we speak to them. Once we entered into this sort of modern domain where there are people who have audiences of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions even, then obviously their power is very great in changing people's thoughts, opinions, and leading them down different paths. And like you say, there might be very benevolent reasons and intentions behind that, or there might not, or there might be corporate intentions. It's all about selling a product, and they don't care if you go out and steal to buy it, as long as you buy it. So there are all sorts of intentions behind this that are often not your best interest. Doesn't have your best interest in mind, you know?
Well, it's another aspect of communication, how we communicate, and sometimes in those clandestine ways, communication happens without our knowing. And that, I thought, right now, with all of the things we are exposed to on so many different levels, it really is important to reconnect people with their own inner wisdom, that insight that they have, that there might be a reason to second guess or third guess or fourth guess or re-examine the choices that we make for the programming that we choose to consume. Because it's like anything else. It's feeding us, and sometimes we need to go on a diet. But that's it. So, but going back to what you are, you know, all across the board, your effort to connect and communicate and bring it basically to a higher level, I think also is influenced by your own transcendent experience of knowing there's more to life than just the physical form.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was one of my, and you know, to put it in context, like you, I've had experiences that didn't include any of this, just random experiences of oneness, feelings of connectedness that transcend this normal day-to-day man that I'm supposed to be playing right now, you know? Mm. And these are the things that give you a taste of what's possible and other aspects of reality that we perhaps don't dedicate enough time to talking about and dealing with and developing, you know? It's there for the taking, like anything.
If you were to narrow it down, narrow the focus, the most outrageous, amazing, insightful, maybe takeaway from what you have gleaned in all of this, is there something that stands out that this is all worthwhile? This made it, you know, this made it all worth it.
As in an experience or a...
Yeah, an experience might be the best way. Is something that shook you to your core, that oh wow moment. Like when some people, they don't get it until they check out. And it's like when the last thing that Steve Jobs supposedly said to his sister, I believe as she's the one who's told the story, was he looked up and he said, oh wow, oh wow, oh wow. Okay, so I think we have those moments while we're living. I know I have. And
yes.
So what would that be that maybe lit the fire or, you know, gave you that sense of this is so cool to be here?
I think in my case, it's a drawn out process that I can see a thread running through my life and a series of different experiences, both beautiful and deeply sad, you know, because obviously our great teachers are not only these splendid, magnificent moments, but they're moments where we're face to face with our own mortality or the death of a loved one or these sort of aspects. And so I would say that in my experience, those have been just as equal teachers pointing me in the direction that I've been headed for my whole life. And my elder brother died way too young. He was 36. I was 32 when he died. And that was a big moment in my life that defined where I am today and has enriched me in many ways. And obviously passing through that was traumatic and difficult and presented me with challenges. And yet there was always that still small voice inside me that knew that everything's okay. And that this is, that death in finality is an invention in our minds. There is no such finality, you know. We are eternal beings, and this life that we're currently living is a little blink of the eye in the cosmic vision that's behind that. So yeah, that's what I try and express. That's what I try and put words to. And there are many ways of doing it, and through film, through book, through the spoken word. I think everything that I'm attempting to do has that common thread of communicating the eternal in this realm of time and matter, you know.
A personal question. Have you connected with your brother? Have you heard from him?
There were a series of very strange things that happened. In fact, in the filming of Mind Your Mind, there was a day when I was filming in this beautiful natural place not far from where I live here, up in the mountains, and I was by myself. And the camera, and I was very much thinking of my brother that day. He was with me in my thoughts constantly, and there was a very strange moment when I expected him to come around the corner. And it was just a weird feeling that I had regarding him. And when I got home and checked the footage, there were zooms and things that the camera had done. I couldn't program. This was a simple camera. It didn't have any programming. And it was doing things that was improving my shots. And I still have no explanation as to what was going on with that. And other things that have happened. So to answer your question, I'd say yes, perhaps not in a direct fashion, but certainly in these sort of indirect fashions that leave you just extremely puzzled and blown away.
Yeah. See, I think those are just as powerful. I think those are, it's the same thing. It's that yes, thing that yes. says this is impossible and it's happening. So it's real. That to me, it makes it real. I like the way you say he was improving your shots.
Sorry?
I like the way you say he was improving your shots, which, you know, that's what are brothers for, you know?
Absolutely. There were shots where I walked across the shot and it zoomed into me and I was like, how did that happen? There's no automatic zoom. It was really mind blowing.
Yeah. The electronics, I think, is that's a key component for the connection. It makes it happen. And then we have to say, how do you do that? How do you do that? It's just one more way of saying, yep, there's more going on than we are able to realize at this point. And that's what keeps it interesting.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so the book is available and your other books are available. You have everything on your website, jasonbrettsearle.com. Is there anything else you would like to add?
If you're interested in the spiritual traditions of mankind, then go and check out the book is what I'd say. If you're interested in how crazy wisdom might influence and help your life, then I think this is what it was intended to be, was an overview, a broad overview, introducing people to the characters, giving them a deeper sense of what it actually means, bringing some clarity to a theme that's often sort of a little bit obscure and murky. And what I attempt to do is lay out the landscape of the interior consciousness and where crazy wisdom fits upon it. So it was a joy in writing, and it's actually published today in the UK. So today is the publishing day.
Excellent timing. Wow. I will add, though, the NLP master and licensed hypnotherapist, you do take clients.
Yes, I do.
So if anybody after hearing this who is curious and might want to see what direction it might go, they could connect with you.
Absolutely. Through my website, and there's a contact tab there. And yes, by all means.
The Monkey in the Bodhi Tree, Crazy Wisdom and the Way of the Wise Fool, Jason Brett Searle.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. Thanks for the conversation. And thank you for your time. It's been thoroughly enjoyable. A lot of seekers can be yearning after that experience for years and hold it out in front of them like the carrot. Ultimately, what we're seeking is not that.
Website, jasonbrettsearle.com. Thanks for listening.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.